This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at the ongoing developments of the right-wing siege of the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C.
Even as the U.S. government has created a hot mess in Venezuela, they're now rattling their sabers against Iran. We break the story of what's happening outside the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., and speak with the attorney for the Embassy Protector Collective.
We speak with our own Michael Stephen Smith about his newly released book, Lawyers for the Left.
The subtitle is In the Courts, In the Streets, and On the Air. The book came in part out of this radio show.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, there's some fishy things going on at Harvard Law School involving Professor Ronald Sullivan. He wanted to represent or be on the legal team defending Harvey Weinstein, and lo and behold, students complained, and he is now withdrawn from the team of lawyers and also been relieved of his position as faculty dean at an undergraduate house.
Yeah.
What does this mean?
Yeah, well, it's not a good development. Attorneys representing unpopular people really are representing the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And I guess the Harvard law students don't quite understand that. You can go all the way back 200 years when John Adams, the third president of the United States and a Harvard graduate, represented a British redcoat in 1774 who was accused of murder. Adams got him acquitted because he was actually innocent. Or bringing it up to date, Bill Kunstler represented a mafia boss on the question of whether the mafia boss had the right to pick his own attorney. Or our own Michael Ratner represented people on the question of habeas corpus in Guantanamo. Even some of those people were bad guys and terrorists. So what attorneys are doing is representing due process and the rule of law. And evidently the Harvard students don't understand that.
Michael, what you've just described is to me the most basic premise of our legal system and should be of our legal education, the right to a trial. Now, let me read something from CNN. Professor Ronald Sullivan Jr. and his wife, Harvard law lecturer Stephanie Robinson, were both deans of Winthrop House. It's one of 12 undergrad residential houses in the Boston area university. When their term ends this June 30th, they're the first black faculty deans in Harvard's history, if you can believe that. What they cite as the decision by the university not to review the couple's deanship is a generally, quote, deteriorating climate in the 400-student house. It says, over the last few weeks, students and staff have continued to communicate concerns about the climate in Winthrop House to the college. The concerns expressed have been serious and numerous. Michael, this is one of the most outrageous things I've ever heard. What is happening on college campuses?
Yeah, this seems to me to be really excessive. I mean, I don't think there's any dispute amongst us that Harvey Weinstein is not the kind of guy you'd want your daughter to date. On the other hand, we have a constitution to protect. And if Harvard law professor steps forward and becomes part of a legal team, they should leave him alone. I mean, actually, Clarence Darrow, our great hero, represented the murderers Leopold and Loeb because he wanted due process and he wanted to make an argument against the death penalty. Attorneys should be free
to represent
the Constitution. Look at Lynn Stewart,
representing the blind sheikh.
Lynn Stewart's another example. And to have this happen at Harvard Law School, the leading law school in the country, is really scandalous. Democracy and the rule of law are being rapidly unraveled in our country by President Trump, his advisors, especially convicted war criminal Elliot Abrams, who was put in charge of policy in Venezuela, and John Bolton, who said that if the top 10 floors of the United Nations building were lopped off, it wouldn't make any difference, and with the support of the rightist insurgent Republican Party. The latest example is the American government's failed attempted military coup in Venezuela and its support of the ongoing attack on the Venezuelan embassy here in Washington, D.C. On April 30th, the USA tried and failed to overthrow the democratically elected Venezuelan president Nicolas Maduro. They failed to supplant him with Juan Guaido, the self-proclaimed president whose only real power is outside of Venezuela and comes mostly from the Trump administration. Back home in Washington, D.C., right-wing counter-revolutionaries in support of Guaido have so far failed in their attempt to take over the Venezuelan embassy. Under international law, the embassy is considered the property of Venezuela itself. Last week, the Washington, D.C. utility company, undoubtedly at the request of the U.S. government, turned off the building's water and electric supply. Washington, D.C. police and the Secret Service are preventing people from bringing food and water into the embassy. A number of American citizens acting in support of democracy in Venezuela entered the building last month to protect it against an invasion by coup supporters. They are also demonstrating outside of the building. Last Tuesday, the police handed the protesters a trespass notice. The notice said that the Trump administration recognizes Venezuela opposition leader Juan Guaido as the head of the government of Venezuela, and that the Guaido-appointed ambassador to the United States, Carlo Vecchio, and his appointed ambassador to the Organization of American States, the OAS, Gustavo Tare, were to determine who was allowed into the embassy. Those not authorized by the ambassadors were to be considered trespassers. Those inside the building were requested to depart the building. The embassy protectors are being represented by attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard of the Washington, D.C. Partnership for Civil Justice. Attorney Verheyden-Hilliard has in the past successfully sued both the Washington, D.C. Police Department and the New York City Police Department for their abuse of demonstrators.
Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Mara, you've really been on the front lines in D.C. on this issue. Can you talk about the failed military coup in Venezuela as the background to the attempted takeover of the Venezuelan embassy in D.C.? The U.S. media obviously plays down the defeat of the April 30th attempted coup, implying that the people of Venezuela oppose the government and that only the military supports it. But the next day on May 1st, May Day, there was a huge outpouring of support for Maduro. Please talk about this, if you will.
Well, what we're experiencing here in Washington, D.C. is the Trump administration, and that would, of course, include Mike Pompeo and warmonger John Bolton and war criminal Elliot Abrams, all of them trying to orchestrate a coup in another country, specifically in Venezuela. And what's happening here in Washington is the effort to seize the diplomatic mission of the government of Venezuela in plain violation of international law, specifically including the Vienna Convention. And there have been peace activists who have been lawfully present inside the embassy for more than a month. They were there lawfully present as the invitees of the entity lawfully in possession of the building. They were given the right to remain. They have been given keys, and they've been there peacefully. But what happened on April 30th going into May 1st was the formation of an extraordinary violent mob outside the building that plainly appeared to be coordinating with law enforcement, and obviously law enforcement is acting under the direction of the federal government. So at this moment that the Trump administration was trying to orchestrate a coup in Venezuela, where they had their puppet Guaido handpicked and anointed by Mike Pence and others to stand up and announce, you know, that the day had come and that the military was joining him, and instead it was a complete failure. The military was not joining him. He had Lopez by his side, who by the late in the day had fled to the Chilean embassy and then fled from there to the Embassy of Spain in Caracas. So they needed, we think, a photo op of seizing the embassy in Washington, D.C. and having the fake ambassador, who has been anointed by Guaido, you know, walk in the doors of the embassy. And to that end, we saw this formation of just the most extraordinary lawlessness, siege, people being physically allowed to attack the building, smashing security cameras. People were breaking into the building, local law enforcement and federal law enforcement, who are obliged by law to protect that diplomatic mission, did nothing to stop it.
We're speaking with Mara Hayden-Hilliard, the attorney from Washington, D.C., who is the attorney for the Embassy Protector Collective. Mara, you were in consultation with the police in Washington, D.C. yesterday. Can you give us an update on the status?
Well, the federal government, the State Department, is really the entity in charge, and they are giving direction to both the State Department federal officers on the scene, as well as Secret Service officers, and then there are Metropolitan Police Department officers there. So we have multiple jurisdictions present, multiple agencies present. And last week, the electricity was cut to the building. PEPCO, the power company here, officially cut the electricity to the building. Water was also cut, which appears to have been an act of sabotage. The people inside were, you know, plunged into darkness, remain there without without power, plainly at the direction of the State Department. And but people have been resilient. And what the law enforcement was doing is they were allowing this mob siege not only to commit violent assaults, I mean physical assaults right in front of them against peace activists, where they do not arrest, where they do nothing. But additionally, when people have been attempting to bring food to the people inside, the government has both used law enforcement officers to themselves block food, and additionally they have allowed the mob outside to physically, not only physically block food, physically block passage. And we're talking about passage on a public right-of-way, absolutely allowing them in front of them to block people from being able to move forward to get food to the building, but also allowing them to seize people's personal belongings, this right-wing mob, to allow them to seize food and steal the food packages. There was an incident starting on Monday where someone again tried to deliver food and using a rope pulley system, and the police stood by while the mob attacked the people attempting to peacefully deliver food. The police stepped in only to themselves cut the rope to make sure that the people inside can't get food. So because these efforts have failed, and because I believe the government acknowledged that people there were in fact invited and lawfully present, I mean, if they were not lawfully present, they would use legal process to remove them. But they did not. And instead, they were trying to use a mob siege, deprivation of food, cutting off of utilities in order to force them out. But the people inside have been resolute in their view and their presentation that they are standing for peace, that they are acting in service to peace and to the Vienna Convention. They have expressed very clearly their desire to make sure that the Trump administration cannot go forward with violations of both domestic and international law. And then what we just had happen was an attempt by the government. The federal law enforcement came. They had the locks cut off the front of the building. I was present. I went to the front door. We believed that they were going into arrest. And what happened was really interesting. What happened in those moments was that as they opened the doors, the activists who were inside were standing in the foyer. They were very peaceful, as they have been consistently. They were holding signs around their necks saying, you know, no coup, and saying that they were standing for international law and protecting the Vienna Convention. And they told law enforcement present very, very clearly that what the cascade effect would be, that if U.S. officials are going to enter a diplomatic mission which is inviolable under the Vienna Convention, and they are signaling to the world over that no diplomatic compound can be safe, that any host country can designate and anoint someone else to be the leader of another country and either hand over the keys or seize a mission. And after extensive discussion and presentation of this, there was a lot of discussion back and forth, clearly, that law enforcement was having with whoever is making decisions. And at some point, they stepped back. They decided not to enter further into the building, though the activists were standing right there and were clearly not going to physically resist anything, but plainly vocalizing their point of view. And law enforcement stepped back and shut the doors behind them and then secured the doors with, like, plastic handcuffs.
Mara, point of information. You've mentioned the Vienna Convention. Tell our listeners what that is.
The Vienna Convention is a treaty that the U.S. government signed. It is a ratified treaty among nations. And what it does is it protects diplomatic relations and protects, specifically here, diplomatic missions. And it requires a host country to respect the inviolability of a mission, and also to protect that mission in the host country from damage, from violence, from seizure by external forces. And, you know, to say plainly, I mean, the U.S. government certainly would reject what happened in 1979 in Iran or Benghazi or anywhere else, and the idea that the U.S. government, even in its own interests, that the Trump administration would endanger its own diplomatic personnel the world over. I mean, they're tearing up the Vienna Convention, and they're doing this at the same time that, of course, they're violating, you know, fundamental precepts with regard to the UN Charter, with the threats of violence and threats of war against the country of Venezuela.
Mara, what happens if the police do enter the embassy and remove the occupiers?
Well, we don't know. I think we certainly anticipated that that's what was happening on Monday because there was a statement that was affixed to the doors of the building and handed out. It's been circulated. It said it for the first time stated. The statement says that the U.S. government asserts that the people inside are trespassing. It's the first time there's been any statement of this type, that the U.S. government recognizes Guaido and Guaido's asserted ambassador. And that notice was pasted on the doors of the building and handed around. Very interestingly enough, that notice has no letterhead on it, and it's signed by no one. So while law enforcement stuck that on the door, it's really sort of extraordinary that no one seems to be identified as the author of the document. I mean, is the State Department the author of the document? Who is the author of the document? But that's been placed there. So I was out there again yesterday, and we were trying to determine what the next steps were. For the first time after the cutting off of the locks and the incident Monday night, where I think everyone believed that the people inside were going to be removed, but then the government stepped back, they finally have moved the mob back from besieging the building. I mean, the mob had broken in. They had people who had broken in twice to the building. And when they were removed, the Secret Service didn't arrest them. I mean, broke in and entered, and they weren't arrested. They were simply just kind of patted on the back and put back in the crowd. People were apprehended with drills, breaking in through doors. People have smashed lights, all of this in front of law enforcement. Not once have they arrested any of these people. So now, at least for the moment, this mob has been pulled back from the physical assault on the embassy. But it is critically important that anybody who cares about peace, anybody who cares about just fundamental core precepts of international law and peace between nations, has to speak up about this. The silence from many liberals and from many in the Democratic Party has been deafening. And why anyone would believe that they want to follow the direction of Trump, Bolton, of Pompeo, of Abrams is completely unimaginable.
Mara, who is this mob? Is it people of different ages? Do they carry identifying signs or T-shirts that lets you know where they're coming from?
Well, the mob, the people who've been there, who have been, you know, just this violent, besieging, blocking mob that have grabbed people's food, that have physically assaulted protesters, peaceful protesters and supporters, they assert themselves as being, you know, the quote-unquote Venezuelan opposition. And, of course, they assert that they're speaking for the people of Venezuela. But, of course, one has to note that people of Venezuela are not the wealthy elites who've been able to establish residency in Washington, D.C. And, in fact, some of the people who are there have been identified as being affiliated or currently working for a number of interesting entities, including the Heritage Foundation, the Koch Institute, Raytheon. So there are others there, too, who appear to be officials working directly with the Guaido formation. So this is not just sort of a random collection of what's happening there.
I haven't seen photographs of this mob, but my assumption is that they're white people and probably middle or upper class. Is that true?
Yes, and not only that, but in addition to the illegality of the physical assaults and the violence and the property damage and destruction, which is just extraordinary that there's no apprehension or arrest for this conduct, many people among this group and in front of all the others have routinely, regularly, and not aberrationally hurled the most disgusting racist insults at black peace activists who have been present, homophobic and transphobic slurs, just constantly off the charts, misogynist attacks. And when peace activists walk through the crowd, when we have walked through the crowd, when I've walked through the crowd, when I was trying to get through to check on the safety of people inside the building, they have, in addition to physically assaulting people, there is a regular amount of death threats and rape threats. And this is not just a peaceful opposition making its views known. This is what appears to be an extremely coordinated and unsafe operation.
We're speaking with Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, the attorney for the Embassy Protector Collective in Washington, D.C. Mara, according to a new study by the Center for Economic and Policy Research, as many as 40,000 Venezuelans have died since August 2017 as a direct result of the U.S.-imposed sanctions. Your thoughts on this?
I think that we all understand that sanctions are an act of war, and the U.S. government is already waging war against Venezuela. And the fact that the administration and everyone in the Democratic Party that is supporting this effort is willing to stand by while thousands and thousands, 40,000 as you note in that report, have died because the U.S. is strangling the country. I mean, the U.S. has a strong desire to plunge the country into misery, as they have done with other countries when they have attempted to punish the population for not agreeing to the U.S. government's determinations about who the population's leader should be. And the effort, of course, is always to destabilize the country so much in the hope that the population will turn against the government because it is suffering so greatly. This is an illegal interference, and it is illegal as an act of war. I mean, that's what sanctions are. The government and other politicians, the Trump administration and Democratic politicians, always put out this false lie as if there's targeted sanctions that are just, you know, affecting particular individuals or particular industries. But at the point at which the U.S. government is seizing the assets of another country, handing them over to their appointed, anointed, preferred puppet leader, when they are starving people, depriving them of food, of medicine, of the things that people need to live, I mean, this is a war crime.
Yeah, I would add that the people in Cuba are now being rationed food. The United States is turning the screws on Cuba, just like they've done to Venezuela, and people are now getting in line to get everything from cooking oil to other kinds of food. It's part of a whole strategy, I believe. But let me ask you this about the elections in Venezuela. Nicolai Maduro was elected in 2013. The Carter Center, established by ex-U.S. President Jimmy Carter, called that election the best in the world. Maduro was then reelected in 2018. Yet I've seen no mention of this election in the corporate media. Have you?
The only time they reference the election in the media is, and you can look at, you can search this, repeatedly, the media acting as the dutiful stenographers of the administration constantly say, Maduro claims he was elected, and then they'll put comma or in paren, in an election widely discredited as fraudulent. And they never cite any evidence that would discredit it as fraudulent. That doesn't exist. There's been no citation of this at all. And as you said, the Carter Center and many others and other election observers who are actually there and have actually witnessed the elections have noted that it's not just the individual election, it's the entire procedures for elections there are stronger than the procedures for elections here.
Mara, we have a few minutes remaining. Under international law, any changes or improvements in the Venezuelan government are for the Venezuelan people to make. But Venezuela has a vast amount of oil. Is that what underlines America's policy?
Well, the American officials explicitly stated that. They've said that they have an interest in Venezuela's oil. I mean, that's one thing about the Trump administration. They are so bold that they're quite open and willing to say what they want to do and what they want to take. They've said that they're targeting Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba openly. They've said that they see no reason why American oil companies shouldn't have access to Venezuelan oil. And the point that you're making about it's up to the Venezuelan people to decide who their government is, that is entirely correct. It isn't necessary for people in the United States, frankly, to even take a position. They don't have to take a position with regard to Maduro or not Maduro. It's not our business, Maduro or not Maduro. What is our business is to stop our own government from committing violations of international law, violating the peace, and killing people in our name. That's why the people inside the embassy are standing up and standing up for peace, standing up for both domestic and international law.
Mara, do you contemplate taking any legal action in the courts about what's happened?
We're certainly evaluating and looking at the vast violations of law with an eye towards proper remedies for redress. But in the immediate, again, the most important thing is for people to be contacting their elected officials, for people to be showing up outside the embassy, for people to be demanding that there be what usually happens, which is a third-party country protective agreement put in place. I mean, even in times of war, between countries, even when countries' relations completely break down, the embassies are and embassy staff leaves. Embassies are placed under the protection of a neutral third party. That is what happens. That's what needs to happen here.
Yeah, that's what happened. For example, when the United States broke off relations with Cuba.
Right, and actually, think about that. I mean, even in the midst of the Bay of Pigs invasion, the U.S. government did not hand the Cuban embassy over to the Bay of Pigs invaders. I mean, that is not what happens. Once you start doing this, once the U.S. government signals to the world that this is the way embassies are going to be treated, that diplomatic compounds are going to be treated, they are going to have a cascade effect and unleash a huge danger towards even the semblance and small elements of world peace that are in place.
It's frightening to us to see the degeneration of the rule of law both internationally and nationally.
Yes, it's frightening to see it, and it's frightening to see the complicity of virtually every member of Congress, of the Senate, and the silence of people. I mean, you know, you turn on the news programs, and of course it's just an endless drumbeat of go look at Russia, this or that, instead of actually focusing on the crimes being committed by the Trump administration in broad daylight right now, and crimes that will have an impact that are going to affect us and affect generations to come, and that we have to stop.
Do the Embassy Protector Collective, do they have a website? Is it possible for people to contact them or support them or even come down to Washington, D.C. to demonstrate? How are people being guided in that respect?
There are several websites that people can look at for those that are supporting them. Popular Resistance, Kevin Zeese, Margaret Flowers, they are among those inside the embassy. You can go to their Popular Resistance website. Code Pink, of course, has been a leader in terms of what is going on here and has also been present in the embassy. So you can go to Code Pink's website and also, of course, all their social media. And the Answer Coalition is also had people that were and has people that are among embassy protectors and has been a core organizer providing support. And there are demonstrations outside the embassy in support of the people inside. So if you go to any of those websites, whether it's Popular Resistance, Code Pink, Answer Coalition, you will find information. These are the three core groups that are make up the Embassy Protection Collective or are in support of it.
Marva Hayden Hilliard, you're a wonderful attorney, and we really applaud what you're doing in support of the Embassy Protector Collective. Do you have any final thoughts before we have to say goodbye?
You know, the one thing that I can say is really reiterating what I have been saying. If anyone is hearing this and they haven't taken action on this, you have to take action on this. You can't be silent. This is a crucial moment. And while you have the Trump administration threatening war with Venezuela and, frankly, already at war with the sanctions and attempting to seize a diplomatic compound, you have them threatening war with Iran. This is not a time for people to be sitting at home and watching CNN or MSNBC or whatever else that is just endlessly just chattering and has no role in actual change and making things happen. It's the people who are going to come together and have been coming together and are taking actions here that are the ones that are going to be the moving force if we're going to change what's happening right now.
Words to end on, Mara. Always a pleasure to have you on. Be safe out there.
Thank you, and thank you so much for bringing this up on your show.
Thank you, Mara. We'll be back to you for an update on this. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Lawyers for the Left, in the courts, in the streets, and on the air, is the title of the just-published book by our own Michael Stephen Smith. It profiles some of the nation's most effective agents of social change. Michael discusses how he came to write this book and previews several of the movement lawyers profiled therein. As Chris Hedges says, quote, "The lawyers in this book valiantly fought the erosion of justice and assault on the court system." Michael, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, and welcome, Heidi. I'm glad to be here with you to talk about lawyers for the left.
Michael, tell us about the origins of this new book.
Lawyers for the Left came out of our radio show, Law and Disorder, which in turn came out of 9/11. Because as you know, Heidi, you've been up to visit me. At that time, I lived right across the street from the Twin Towers. In fact, had the building fallen over sideways instead of on itself, it would have fallen on me. I was up there with my wife and my 16-pound cat, Mo, and my talking parrot, Charlie Parker. When the planes hit the World Trade Center, the neighborhood turned black. Then the second building came down and turned black again. We were totally covered with about 4 inches of toxic dust, and we had no telephone or water or lights, nothing. The cops told everybody in the building to evacuate, and we weren't very portable with the animals, so we stayed there overnight. But the next day, they told us we had to get out. So we left Mo because he was too heavy to carry, and we took Charlie, put him in his traveling cage, and we started walking up to the village to stay with Michael Ratner and Karen Minucci in their home up there. And on the way, Charlie kept telling everybody we encountered, "It's okay, it's okay." But it wasn't okay. That's when we got the idea to start our radio show. Law and Disorder was a proposition that we made to WBAI almost 15 years ago. They put us on every other week. And then they put us on every week. And by the time Michael passed away 3 years ago, we had 60 stations listening to us, and now we have 120. So Colin Robinson, the co-publisher of OR Books, said, you know, these interviews that you've done with these significant lawyers are really terrific. Why don't you transcribe and edit them, and we'll publish them? And that was the origin of the book. You and I and Michael interviewed these wonderful people. We've got 23 chapters in the book. Half of it are the interviews that we did. The other half are articles that I wrote about various lawyers like Bill Kunstler, Conrad Lynn, Bruce Wright, Haywood Burns, significant figures in American social history. So that's where the book came from, and it's just came out. People can get it at OR Books, orbooks.com, and order it directly. I've been on a little bit of a speaking tour, so this was not the hardest gig I've ever gotten, and I'm glad to be here with you to talk about it.
Michael, what is the underlying theme to the book?
Corporate capitalism is increasingly not compatible with democracy. That's what we think. That's what a number of the lawyers that we profile in the book articulate. I think that would be the underlying theme.
Michael, what is the law?
Well, liberals think the law is a system of rules and regulations so that people can resolve disputes between themselves or between themselves and the government, and any mistakes that are made can be corrected. That's the law. But Bill Kunstler had a different definition of the law, which I think is a much wiser one. Bill said that the law is, in fundamental essence, nothing more than a method of control created by a socioeconomic system determined at all costs to perpetuate itself by all means necessary for as long as possible. Well, I think that what Michael Tiger said about Bill Kunstler's quote, Michael said, well, that's half right. But if you're batting 500, you can still lead the league. And Michael added something that I'm sure Bill would agree with, and that's that you can't just rule by repression. You can't have six cops on every street corner. I mean, you could, but it's a hard, expensive way to rule.
And not effective, I might add.
And not effective. And so they rule in a different way, a much more subtle way. They rule by myths. There's a mythology that we live in a democracy. There's a mythology that we have a marketplace of ideas. We're all created equal, you know, with the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, we're not all created equal. My son is not equal to Donald Trump's sons. And there is no equal opportunity. They say there is, but there's not. But it's those myths that perpetuate this increasingly unfair and scary society.
Your book contains individuals who we here on Law and Disorder would really call luminaries. Let's start with Lynn Stewart.
A courageous luminary. We interviewed her many times, and we print in the book one of the interviews. You know, as you know, Lynn represented the famous blind sheikh in a case in the mid-90s. And after he was framed up and convicted and sent to a maxi prison in Minnesota, she went out to visit him. And her purpose in visiting him was to then issue a press release to try to keep his name in front of the public. And she did that, and nothing happened. She violated a rule. It was a slap-on-the-wrist rule. And 2 years later, after 9/11, and after Bush got elected, Ashcroft, John Ashcroft, Bush's attorney general, was looking to make an example out of an attorney and scare them from representing anybody accused of terrorism. So they went back and they found what Lynn Stewart had done when she issued that press release, and they indicted her for materially giving assistance to terrorism. What was the material assistance? A press release. And they tried her downtown, a couple blocks from 9/11. They put big 8-by-10-foot photographs of Osama bin Laden on the walls. They scared the jury to death. The jury came back with a guilty verdict. Well, the judge was not unsympathetic to Lynn Stewart, and he sentenced her to 28 months in prison. Now, here's a woman who had survived cancer, and 28 months in prison wasn't going to do her any good. But he could have sentenced her to like 30 years. Well, when Bush's cousin, Judge Walker, who sits on the appellate court, saw Lynn Stewart on television, this is what happened. Lynn went on Democracy Now, and Amy Goodman asked her, Lynn, if you had it to do all over again, would you do it? And Lynn said, yes, I think I would. The judge was enraged. He directed the trial judge, Codal, to resentence her, which you can do in the federal system. And Codal sentenced her to 10 years in prison. Now, here's a 65-year-old grandmother with cancer in remission, and they sent her to a prison in Texas. She was on death's door. They let her out to allow her to die at home, and she didn't die on him. She lived for another couple of years, and she continued to talk publicly about what had happened to her and what had happened to the decline of democracy in the country. A real, true profile in courage.
Michael, you referenced Bruce Wright a few minutes ago. Who was he? And talk a bit about him.
Bruce was a great African-American judge from Harlem. He had been in the Second World War, and he had been wounded. He got a medal. He was coming back home, and a white racist officer looked at him and said, I didn't know they allowed niggers to fight. So he thought, this is what Bruce writes about. This is a quote from his book. So Bruce thought, what am I going back to that country for? And he stayed in Paris. He came back 16 months later and practiced law. He represented some of the great bebop musicians, among other things. And in the 70s, when Mayor Lindsay, who was a classy guy, was looking to appoint judges, he called Bruce downtown, and he said, I'd like you to be a judge. And Bruce said, well, I'd like to be a judge, too, but I don't think I can afford it. And Mayor Lindsay said, no, I'm not asking for a contribution. I want you to be a judge. So Bruce took the bench. He was a criminal court judge for many years. The thing that got him in trouble was when he gave bail to a black man accused of killing a cop. Well, the Policeman's Benevolent Association went crazy. And I remember the demonstrations that we had in front of the municipal building in support of Bruce Wright. Nonetheless, he was relieved of his job on the bench.
And didn't the police have a nickname for him, Michael? Let him loose, Bruce?
Turn him loose, Bruce.
Turn
that
him
was
loose,
the headline
Bruce.
On the Daily News. Turn him loose, Bruce. Well, Bruce turned around and ran for judge up in Harlem, got elected. He was overwhelmingly popular with the citizens of Harlem, as well as the attorneys. I appeared before him a number of times. He was intelligent and polite and kind to attorneys. He was a joy. We all thought that. He was so popular in the city that his favorite encomium, he relates in the book, is he was riding his bike down 125th Street and got knocked off, and he was laying there in the roadbed, seriously injured, and a fellow came up and looked down at him and said, oh, S-H-I, it's the judge. So that's one of the profiles in Lawyers for the Left, Bruce Wright.
Talking about someone who is still with us and very active in Washington, D.C., is Mara Verheiden Hilliard, another frequent guest on Law & Disorder.
Well, I hope that we can play a clip from our interview with her. She won two significant cases that you know a lot about, Heidi, against the police for disrupting and busting up mass demonstrations, both here in New York City and in Washington, D.C. And in Washington, she got new rules written, so they can't do that anymore. And her thought was, we got to keep the movement in the streets. Social change comes from below. And I take cases not just because they're First Amendment cases, but because they're social change cases. I take cases to empower the movement.
We call her the queen of protest defense. Michael, let's play a clip from one of our interviews with Mara.
Good idea.
All social change, all historical change in the United States that has made a difference for people has come from below. It has come from popular movements and popular struggle, not because the politicians decide to give people rights, but because there is that feeling that the people are demanding them and that they are going to force it to happen. So that at the end of the day, we don't see the issue being just, do we get a judge on the bench to agree with us, and that's it. It's also making sure that there is space for people to be able to express themselves. So in that way, we turn to our clients again and again to make sure that we are working both with our clients and with community organizations in service of their ultimate struggles.
And in fact, you're reminding me of Arthur Kanoy, longtime Guild member who was a hero of many Guild members.
Of many of us.
And in fact, that's what Arthur told legions of law students and young lawyers, is that you have to listen to the people you're serving. We take their message from them. And so often, traditional attorneys will advise clients in a certain way. But I think that you and Carl and the partnership really are fabulous listeners.
Oh, thank you.
And knowing that these cases do take, as you say, upwards of 10 years and even more, I would suppose that many attorneys might be tempted to take shortcuts. Can you give some pointers for how you hang in there for the long haul in this kind of case?
Well, first of all, I have to say that we have fabulous plaintiffs and clients. We are so honored to be able to work with people who are absolutely committed to the underlying issues, the issues that they went on the streets for to begin with, and then the issues that arise in the context of litigation. So that in these cases, for example, these two long-running mass arrest cases that we've been litigating, one since 2000, one since 2002, that we've recently settled in the past year, these cases, our clients said to us whenever we communicated with them that their ultimate goal was to make sure that what happened to them never happened to anyone else. In both these cases, there's more than 1,000 people, class members that we're representing, who were engaged in peaceful protests in Washington, D.C., and the police came in and surrounded them and swept people off the streets, took parents and their children, separating them, took protesters, took bystanders, tourists, held them on buses in punitive, abusive conditions with their hands tied up behind them, and then took them to like a police gym floor where they were hogtied and people were tied up wrist to ankle in stress and duress positions for more than 24 hours, unable to extend their backs.
Oh.
And the sadism and cruelty of this is, you know, extreme, coming from the police department and ratified by the municipality. But all of our clients wanted to fight these cases out to make sure that we could change the landscape in D.C. And that's what we set out to do, and that's what the fight goes on so long for. Because I think that, you know, the municipalities, the governments, they want these cases to go on as long as possible. They want to fight a war of attrition because they want plaintiffs to feel like they have to take toothless settlements and walk away with, you know, little that they've accomplished. And they want to make it hard for them to find attorneys who are willing to stay and fight for the decade that it takes. And we were willing to do that. Our clients are willing to do that. And so, for example, in D.C., it has changed here. I mean, not to say that we don't think, you know, with an upsurge of social justice movement, the police won't violate the law again in some way, and we'll be in court that day. But the fact is, right now, the law has changed in D.C. We have training in place. We've changed the way the police operate. They can't use these tactics. These specific tactics that we took apart piece by piece have been removed from the arsenal of the police department in D.C.
Mara, can you talk specifically about the changes, and I believe the city council was involved in this process, in 2004, I think, to the manual that the police use for how they treat demonstrators?
Well, there were two elements of change. In a number of our cases, we've had more than those two mass arrest cases, and in a series of cases we've brought over the past decade, we have, as part of equitable relief in our cases, gotten changes in the police mass demonstration manual and their training programs, their requirements. But as well, there was a change in the law, which goes beyond the manual, which in 2004 and took effect in 2005, which is the First Amendment Rights and Police Standards Act. And that law specifically actually tracked the demands we were making in our cases so that, for example, the police can't just throw up these pop-up police lines and surround demonstrators and stop a demonstration, not allow people to leave, arrest them. They can't use that trap and detain, trap and arrest tactic. They can't hold people for long periods of time. If people are arrested in D.C. for, you know, basic nonviolent offenses in the context of First Amendment activity, they have to be let out 4 hours now if they're arrested by the D.C. police. They cannot use that wrist-to-ankle handcuffing mechanism against people anymore. And there are a number of other provisions like that. The police have to have their badges plainly available and visible. They can't come out in riot gear to First Amendment assemblies, which, you know, make assemblies look like they're criminal activity when, in fact, it's cherished free speech activity.
And also ratchets up the feeling, the palpable feeling of fear
among protesters.
Yes, and it's an effort to demonize the protesters, one, to send a chill to protesters, but the other, to send a message to everyone else that might think, you know, I care about this issue. I want to go out and I want to stand up for what I believe in. But then you look at it and you think, maybe it's dangerous. Shouldn't.
That was Mara Verheiden-Hilliard. Speaking of another creative and bold person, Conrad Lynn brought a lawsuit in 1947 challenging segregation in the U.S. Army. Talk about his strategy.
That was my typo. I think it was 1943. I'm sure it comes as a surprise to many of our listeners that the U.S. Army was segregated, that the war against racist Hitler was fought by a segregated racist army. Conrad Lynn was bold and creative and brought a lawsuit on behalf of his brother, who became a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, on behalf of his brother to desegregate the Army. They lost that suit. But when Truman became president, the United States looked so bad in the eyes of the world as such a racist country that they had to do some desegregation in a hurry. They desegregated the Army, and as you know, in 1954, they made a pitiful attempt to desegregate schools.
Michael, you write also about Leonard Boudin's 15-year-old litigation against the FBI to legalize being a socialist. Talk about that.
And being in a socialist party. The FBI, under the COINTEL program, maintained the position, which it never gave up, maintained the position that they could spy on and disrupt and destroy a socialist organization. And Leonard Boudin, who was the great constitutional litigator of his time, brought a case, the litigation lasted 15 years, on behalf of the Socialist Workers' Party, which was a socialist party of about 3,000 people. He brought the case against the FBI to get an injunction against what the FBI was doing. 10 million pages were produced by the government during the 8-year discovery process. The judge told Leonard, "Mr. Boudin, you're not going to believe what's in these papers." What was in the papers? Well, it showed that the FBI had infiltrated the organization and it inserted 300 informers as members. It used 1,300 spies to report on them. It had FBI agents visit their landlords to get them evicted, visit their employers to get them fired. It bugged their rooms. It burglarized their office many times. It did everything they could to destroy them. It tried to get internal dissent stirred up. It tried to get their reputation tarnished with other movement groups. And it took this magnificent lawsuit that Leonard Boudin started and concluded in the middle 80s, concluded with an injunction against the FBI that they could never do this again and a $268,000 judgment against them. Why is this important? Well, obviously, half the country now would prefer socialism to capitalism, particularly amongst young people. People are identifying with socialism. They're joining socialist organizations. And these organizations are legal, and we would have to be naive to think that the FBI isn't going to do again what it did back then. We've got the law on our side, and we should use it.
Michael, I think that your book, Lawyers for the Left, would be an important addition to a constitutional law course curriculum. With that in mind, what challenges do you see facing the movement and its attorneys today?
I write about that in the introduction to the book, and I'm going to read you a page. "The central fact of our political and legal lives is the overwhelming power the corporate capitalist state has accumulated, especially since 9/11. In previous eras, during the time of fascist dictatorships, Antonio Gramsci wrote from his Italian prison cell that we need, quote, pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the heart. My friend Peter Weiss, a former vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, now in his mid-90s, added to Gramsci's resolve, denial is not an option. Despair is not an option. Resistance is the only option. You have to have hope, Ramsey Clark, also in his 90s, told me. Otherwise, you don't do anything. The attorneys whose lives and achievements are celebrated in this book have worked all their professional lives for the expansion of human rights as opposed to property rights. In so doing, they have worked for true democracy and the rule of law. But for me and many radical lawyers, there's another crucial step. Capitalism ultimately and increasingly is not compatible with democracy and the rule of law. Marx studied law. Both Castro and Lenin and Nelson Mandela were lawyers. For them and for me, there's one way out of the impending catastrophe, the ongoing ecocide, the heightened threat of nuclear annihilation, the crushing of democracy. And that is the building of a mass movement that will take political power to replace our current system with a genuine economic and political democracy. Imagine living in a socialist USA. This book is a compilation of profiles and interviews of radical lawyers. Most of them are from the 60s, my generation. As Lewis Lapham has observed, a person denied knowledge of its past cannot make sense of its present or imagine its future. These lawyers and activists that in one way or another participated in the essential struggles of their own times, they could sense the future in the instant, as Shakespeare said, and they understood that those who are above the struggle are also beside the point. To those lawyers and activists who are themselves deeply immersed in the political life of our stirring and difficult age, I hope this book will introduce new allies and fresh sources of strength.
Michael, I have a final question for you. As you know, the motto of the National Lawyers Guild, of which we're both longtime members, is, quote, "Justice is a constant struggle." Your thoughts?
Bill Kunstler used to say, "There are no green pastures. Every generation has its own struggles." And we see the new generation today taking those struggles up, particularly with respect to the threat of nuclear war, the horrible threat of climate change, and the crushing restriction of democratic rights that we've had ever since 9/11.
Michael, congratulations on a truly important and very timely book.
Well, it's called Lawyers for the Left, in the courts, in the streets, and on the air. And you can get it online by going to orbooks.com. That's orbooks, orbooks.com. And if you push a button, they'll mail you the book.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.